Hello and welcome to the Energy Pioneers Podcast, a show dedicated to the legacy of the pioneers of the offshore oil and gas industry. I'm energy historian Jason Terrio. Each podcast episode features stories of industry pioneers whose leadership, grit, and technological expertise built the modern offshore industry in the Gulf of Mexico and around the world. For more than two decades, the Houston-based Oilfield Energy Center, now the Energy Education Foundation, has honored these legendary men and women by inducting them into the OEC's Hall of Fame. The stories you will hear are from the Hall of Famers themselves, whose original interviews, some recorded 25 years ago, have been digitally remastered and preserved for posterity. Deep water. It's an oil field term typically associated with drilling and producing in water depths beyond the 1,000-foot mark. For much of the industry's history, deep water meant the depth just beyond the tallest existing platform structure or the deepest drilling operation at that time. When the Mr. Charlie stepped out into 40 feet in the early 1950s, that was deep water. When the Blue Water 1, the first semi-submersible drilling rig, jumped out to 300 feet, that too was considered deep water. And when Sun Oil installed a platform in 365 feet of water at West Cameron 639 in 1970, that was truly deep water for a fixed platform, as no other structure existed beyond that range. Beginning in the mid-1970s and the 1980s, engineers and project managers at Shell Oil took the concept of deep water to greater heights with the installation of the Cognac and Bullwinkle fixed platforms in over 1,000 feet of water. And a decade later, those same pioneers revolutionized the offshore industry with the successful development of the tension leg platform, the TLP, in several thousands of feet of water in the Gulf of Mexico. Gordon Sterling, who was inducted into the Offshore Hall of Fame in 2016, had a hand to play in all of these historic deep water projects as a manager for Shell. Born on a farm in northern Ontario, Canada, Gordon Sterling made his civil engineering debut with Shell Oil in 1965. Right at the precipice of historic technological change in the industry. The achievements, innovations, and trial and error during this period laid the foundation for the industry's march into deep water. Gordon had a front row seat for it all and would later take the lead as the company's manager of major deep water projects.
I joined the industry when it was really growing in 1965, and the deepest water was about 200 feet from production. They're drilling a little deeper. And over the years, working with Shell and working with a great team at Shell, we were in the forefront. Mm-hmm. And so I had the pleasure of working on ever-increasing deep water structures. I hadn't come from an oil region, didn't know anything about it, had never seen an oil well. And in those days, you're right, I mean, there was an early training program. We were sent around, you know, mine was cut short because the division said they needed me. I always kind of regretted it, but it was like a 3-month course, or I mean, and before that, I mean, as recently as the early 60s, this was 65, as recently as 60, 61, guys that went through 6 months or a year, you know, of going out to the field and so on. Mine was about two to three months. We went to the training center, and there were you know, experienced, knowledgeable engineers there that we got to know later were really, you know, guys like Bruce Collop, right? And well respected. He'd come in for 2 or 3 days to talk about floating systems, which were just, you know, they weren't, I suppose in some people's minds, they were looking ahead to floating production systems, but he was still talking about floating drilling systems at the time. Anyway, that's how I got into it, and, you know, after a couple of years here, they transferred me to New Orleans to, there was what was called a central design group, and I realized later at the time I didn't, you know, I just interested in what I was doing, but I was sent in, put into the Central Civil Engineering Design Group for offshore structures. And that was a little unusual for Shell, because normally a lot of engineers were rotated into all kinds of different jobs, a lot of my colleagues were. But quite a few of us that ended up working for Pat Dunn, who I'm sure you know, ended up in the civil engineering group. And it changed its formation and how it looked over the years. But it was a highly specialized technical group. You know, I had a definite interest in the marine, the design, you know, as a structural engineer, but of course it broadened over time. I spent some time working on soil mechanics issues too. But no, I think the answer is more along the lines that there was a need. We were getting into managing projects, and we needed some people that would focus in those areas. And you know, it took the company a while. I mean, we were an oil company, and building things and putting them out there initially was sort of, we do that and then we go back to producing, right? Now, the people, well, not that the operations, don't get me wrong, not the operations people don't have a big role, but the people who design and build and install these things have a much bigger role than in the industry than they used to have. Part of the issue as we were in that era coming through is, if you know, how do you get ahead in this company? And for those of us who really love managing projects and being in projects, you know, starting in the 80s and the 90s, it was fine. But up until then, you know, you say, what are you doing out over here? That isn't the main business, right? And but I think the industry in general, the companies in specific, have learned that, yeah, people, really good people who know how to run projects, you know, well, that's what you need.
Yeah.
So we grew into that. Yeah. We learned. I mean, you know, the Cognac platform in the 70s was a fantastic experience, but then we did it high quality, on time, all kinds of technical achievements at 2.5 times the cost that we originally thought, right? But by the time we got to Bullwinkle and to the floaters in the 80s and 90s, it was a pretty good record.
In the late 1970s, Gordon led a team of engineers for the Cognac platform, set in just over 1,000 feet of water in the Gulf of Mexico at Mississippi Canyon 194. The Cognac builders set many industry firsts with this one-of-a-kind engineering marvel. The three-piece jacket, built at J. Ray McDermott Fabricators in Amelia, near Morgan City, Louisiana, was a colossal structure, the largest ever installed in open water at that time. To successfully launch, install, and start up production operations, the Cognac project required record-setting depths for professional divers, underwater pile driving, production risers, and the first use of underwater robotic cameras, the forerunners to today's ROVs. The pure logistics involved in loading out and launching and assembling this three gigantic pieces of welded tubular steel in over 1,000 feet was truly revolutionary, considering the enormous technological challenges faced by Shell's project team and its army of contractors and project engineers at McDermott in the late 1970s, long before the days of computers, GPS, and CAD designing. These offshore pioneers were in the vanguard of deep water technology, and their influence on the industry cannot be easily measured. Myron Rodrigue, another offshore Hall of Fame inductee, was McDermott's project engineer for Cognac. Up until then, the largest jackets being built in the Amelia Yard were in the 300-foot range. Each of the three pieces of Cognac were bigger than that, making Cognac the only one of its kind ever built. I had the honor of interviewing Myron back in 2009, where he talked at length about the many pioneering efforts of designing, measuring, and building Shell's mega deepwater platform.
And then when 1975 hit, you know, you're talking about that was a huge change from 373 feet of water to Cognac, mm-hmm. 1,020 feet of water. That was an amazing, because we didn't know what we didn't know about building something that big. It really was a negotiated deal you know, because McDermott was pretty much the only place that had the resources and the know-how, and it was, you know, then that's what Shell wanted to do, mm-hmm. is have it built there. And so they designed Cognac to be built with the stuff we had. They designed it to be installed with the stuff McDermott had. You know, the biggest derrick barge at the time was a 500-ton derrick barge. I mean, and the three parts by themselves were world-class, I mean, at the time. The top section of Cognac was like a 575-foot jacket. You know, in the midsection and the base section, the midsection was 300 and something feet on its side. And the base was almost, it was 14,500 tons, if I remember. So it was a whole different animal. We had to learn a whole lot of different stuff on Cognac that we didn't know we needed to learn. Just simple measuring steel that long and big and thick, and was something we had to teach ourselves. I mean, I almost drove a guy named Fritz Foucault, almost drove him nuts measuring just a straight leg. I don't remember the dimension, 172 foot 6 inches. I'll never forget it. I measured that leg most probably 500 times before we could repeat the measurement. We had to teach ourselves how to repeat these measurements. Because that was the middle leg of the middle bent, the two middle bents of the base section. And if we couldn't get measurements right, we couldn't, how are we going to make three pieces fit together? So, you know, and then Shell, you know, dimensional control was kind of the birth of dimensional control in the industry, is what I believe. So we were the first people to tackle that and build steel structures to a standard temperature. And so we reduced everything back to, I think, 68 degrees Fahrenheit. But that's, so every time we measure something, we reduced all our dimensions back to a standard temperature. But that was some of the things. That was unique. But that was, I think, a milestone, learning how to measure those big structures.
Now, it was a fascinating project. One of the lessons that we learned from that, sort of after the fact, I mean, at the time that we made the decision to do it, there was a very limited marine equipment. Part of the decision to build it in three pieces was launch barge capacity, derrick barge, as we call them, are now called crane barges, but derrick barge capacity, and so on. And so, looking at it, you know, an alternate solution, which, was it Union followed with a 1,000-foot platform, but an alternate solution was just to build a bigger launch barge. And, I remember later on as I got more into management, reading articles about paradigms and so on, and it's kind of interesting. You can get focused, you know. You can get focused and say, you know, yeah, we know, we can cut the structure apart and we put it together, and we did. Did a great job. Maybe an alternate solution was build a big, humongous launch barge and build the damn thing in one piece.
Which is what you did next.
Which we did next, right? Well, Exxon led the way on that on the West Coast, and we used the same launch barge. But, you know, by then we said, oh, yeah, let's just build. And the Harima group had built those big crane barges in the North Sea. So, you know, but that's how progress is made. But I, as an individual engineer, after it was all through, I was very proud of what we did on it, on Cognac.
In the 1980s, Gordon Sterling led Shell's design, fabrication, and installation of another record-setting deepwater megastructure, Bullwinkle, the tallest fixed steel platform ever placed offshore. With Shell's Bullwinkle at Green Canyon 65, the fixed platform method for deepwater had reached its limits. Around that time, Shell made a series of major deepwater discoveries in water depths beyond the 3,000-foot mark. Figuring out how to commercially and economically develop these prospects pushed Shell's deepwater design expertise to the limits. In addition to the technological aspects of building production systems for these great water depths, major questions arose about whether the economics could even work in deepwater. Sure, engineers could design a system and contractors could build it, but could it be profitable? As the Shell engineers within Gordon's Deepwater Design Group continued to study new options, it became apparent that producing a few thousand barrels a day per well, as was typical of that period, would not lend itself to a profitable venture in deep water. Those wells had to produce more like 5,000 to 10,000 barrels a day. A series of successful but unconventional tests on Bullwinkle proved that with proper techniques and careful reservoir management, wells from deepwater turbidite sands could produce double and even triple the normal daily amount without major issues. From there, Shell set its sights on selecting the optimal production system to essentially design one and build multiple.
Yeah, it was an exciting time, Jason, in the 90s. You know, there was a period there that called the Gulf of Mexico the Dead Sea from an oil point of view. And the other thing, was from my perspective, at that point, Royal Dutch Shell had complete 100% ownership of us, but we were operated very independently. And we were in a position where, as a separate entity there, we had to make the Gulf of Mexico work. I mean, if we didn't, there really wasn't much left for us. You know, we didn't fudge anything, but we really worked hard in the early 90s to say, can we do this? Because to us, our experience was in the deltaic sediments and things of that nature where 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 barrels a day was good production. So we really had to work all the way through from the subsurface and say, can we get, which we ultimately did, wells in the 12,000 barrel a day. We used to work on 2 million barrels total from a well bore. We had to start believing in 5 or 10 million. We used to work 2,000 barrels a day. We had to start believing in 5 to 10, and not just, I remember asking our reservoirs guys to run cases with 5,000 barrels a day. And just, because we had done all kinds of different studies on TLPs and compliant towers, and he ran them and he said, "Of course, Gordon, of course it's going to be very profitable." And I said, more or less, we have run this thing up and down, backwards and every other way, and unless we can physically do that, we can't make it profitable. So at a certain point, the reservoir people said, it'll work. We actually did some tests back on the Bullwinkle wells to see if it would work. So, yeah, that was a time where, we were in another, what I would call a little bit of a paradigm. We were kind of on a subsurface thing, caught up in this, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 barrel a day. That's the best the Gulf of Mexico can do. And there were other companies, including Amoco, which is now BP, that were in the same position, and we started to kind of think we've got to do, we can do it on paper and we show it, this would be very profitable. But we can also show that unless we can physically do that, we're not going to be in business long.
Shell was not alone in its search for commercial deepwater applications. Exxon developed and installed the Lena cable-guided tower in 1,000 foot of water in the early 1980s. Not to be outdone, Conoco built the first prototype tension leg platform, the Hutton TLP, in several hundred feet of water in the North Sea, and built a smaller version of the TLP in the Gulf of Mexico in the late 1980s. Gordon Sterling's New Ventures Group thoroughly analyzed all the available options, and following years of study, finally recommended the TLP to senior Shell management. As manager of deepwater projects throughout the 1990s, Gordon oversaw the successful execution of a series of TLPs in the Gulf with Auger, Mars, Ram Powell, and Urser. These TLP projects, particularly Mars, unlocked the keys to the economics of deepwater and provided an industry blueprint to develop billion-dollar offshore projects in the 1990s during a period of low oil prices.
Well, we had put together, and I was still finishing up on Bullwinkle, but there had been a study group, I don't know what the title, guys like Carl Wickheiser and so on had led it. Bruce Collett was in that group. So they've been a study group to look at the production side. Drilling, you know, kind of the floaters kept moving out and dynamic positioning and all that, so they kept going into deeper water there. But so they had that study group, and at the end of Bullwinkle, after, you know, they were had the discoveries that led to Mars and Ram Powell, Ursa, and all that. We still were looking at options between Compliant Tower and TLP. And we had done enough studies so that we could make some you know, real realistic evaluation. Subsea back to shallow water host was considered, but the distances were, for the knowledge at the time, too far. Might have been a solution today. So when I got into it after Bullwinkle in the early 90s, working on Mars and then the other three later on, that was the evaluation. What do we do? Do we do a TLP floater? Do we do a compliant fixed base tower? Do we do a subsea with tieback to either existing or to shallower water built for it? And there was a lot of studies, and you know, it's interesting. You look at the economics of it, and they sort of came out, you know, within the error band, shall we say. You didn't, you know, we knew our estimates were that estimates, right? Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I was proud of the company at that time. There was some kind of, you know, a lot of reviews, and the senior management at the time said the longer term would be better served if we went with the TLPs at the time. And besides, you know, Exxon developed later what they said, design one and build many. We didn't call it that, but at least there was this concept that we'd learn and we can, you know, we do TLPs, we can stay with it and learn, and we did. So, you know, once we decided that for Mars, then it was, you know, Rand Powell, Ursa, Na Kika was not a TLP, but it was a floater. But then we were getting into, by then I had, about that time I retired, but they were getting into water, deep water, where TLPs didn't work. Yeah. And the spars were the I guess there were spars and FPSs were the two choices, and it depended on the economics, I mean, of the situation. In the mid-95 to 98, somewhere in there, we had, finishing up Mars, Ram Powell, Ursa, and then we had a subsea in 5,400 feet of water, all going on at the same time. And I had three project managers on those separate ones, and a subsea manager. And I was called manager of deep water development, I guess, yeah. It was which in Shell meant, didn't include the drilling. We coordinate a lot, but it meant building these production facilities, the pipelines, the topsides, and the systems, the flow dot. And we built the three TLPs in Italy, and the topsides in the U.S., and the tendons down in Myron's location, I forget where on. A lot of international components, but it was put together in the U.S. So yeah, that was the big. And then I retired in 2000.
It was quite the impressive career, with a litany of industry awards, publications, and achievements, including the OTC Heritage Award in 2008. Under Gordon's watch, Shell successfully opened the deep water and laid a path for others to follow. To give a perspective on Gordon's influence on the industry, we invited Libby Cheney, a former executive at Shell and a longtime committee member for the Offshore Hall of Fame. Welcome, Libby.
Thanks, Jason, for having me on the podcast. It's a privilege to showcase our offshore pioneers and to share their amazing stories. The Energy Education Foundation, formerly the Offshore Energy Center, has honored legendary men and women in its Hall of Fame for over two decades. These pioneers are individuals who distinguish themselves through their vision, drive, innovation, and leadership to build the industry that supplies the world's energy needs. Gordon is a shining example of an offshore pioneer. His contributions and those of his team put Shell at the forefront of technology advancements that allowed ever deeper drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. In addition to his work with Shell, Gordon volunteered countless hours as chair and member of the Hall of Fame committees to recognize other industry pioneers and their contributions. It is a great honor to recognize Gordon through this podcast. He's a true example of this industry's exceptional pioneers.
I think it was an interesting time, right? I mean, we had a lot of challenges early on. We didn't have the amount of guidance from codes and standards that current groups do. There's a lot of individual initiative. Not necessarily that there isn't today, but it was a different world. I mean, I suppose one could say almost too much. I don't think so. But we didn't have too many go-bys early on, or even as we went on. You know, I mean, for us, other people had built TLPs, but not to the degree we did. And then, you know, so each one of these was new and a challenge. It really was, right from the beginning. It just kept being, you know, kept working in deeper and deeper water, which brought more and more issues, more and more problems. Need to engage other areas. ROVs came in, you know.
Right.
That's one area I just, you know, without the RO, the underwater robots, we wouldn't be doing what we're doing. And they have a limited but just absolutely vital role. So, yeah, we were all learning as we went along. You know, we get to a point on Cognac, we actually had divers go down at 900 and some feet. Every time we had to put them in the water, I just cringed. But now we kept, there's got to be a solution. Well, the Navy had been working on it. We learned from them. And now, you know, we send robots down to 10,000 feet.
Yeah.
And I guess I'm rambling a bit, but being involved with a group that was almost always looking forward, very seldom routine, really. You know, it was, you know, another project, practically never the same, usually in either deeper water or more, you know, harsher situation or something. My particular career was almost exclusively in the Gulf of Mexico. I did work for a year or so on a West Africa project, always in Houston. A lot of great people, both in Shell and in the industry, that, you know, just contributed an awful lot. And I think things like this are, you know, helpful to archive that.
Yes, sir.
This concludes our episode of the Energy Pioneers Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Terrio. Stay tuned for more episodes, and be sure to check out the new Energy Education Foundation website at energyeducation.org, where you can learn more about the Offshore Hall of Famers. And if you ever come to Galveston, Texas, be sure to visit the Ocean Star Offshore Drilling Rig Museum, which pays tribute to the men and women and companies that built the offshore oil and gas industry.